welcome to this week's edition of the NinersNation.com Better Rivals podcast. My name is Oscar Aparicio, and this week it's free agency and the 49ers have quantified their love. We now have elegant tank tops in the merch store just in case. And with me this week, it's lifelong Browns fan. It's one Mr. David Newman.
Hello. I've got my John Dorsey sweater. I've got my Baker Mayfield headband. I'm ready to roll. Baker to OBJ. Touchdowns all year.
What's it been like suffering through the indemnity of being a Browns fan for all of 16 hours?
Lifelong, you know, it's been a struggle my entire life dealing with all those losing seasons. But, you know, it's going to all be worth it when they win the Super Bowl this
year.
Yeah,
it's going to be legit. So let's, man, the Browns, they've been doing things well.
They're doing some things. It's going to be fun to watch them.
I have a friend who's a Browns fan, and I told him that Sashi was the perfect person to get all of the capital, and Dorsey was probably the perfect person to spend it. I don't know that Dorsey if you could put those two humans into one.
Right. Maybe they should have just stayed working together.
Yeah. It would have been great. But all right, it's the free agency pod. Lots of thoughts. Let's crack open the beer. I did have my many Jerick thoughts. McKinnon official beer since RIP Jerick McKinnon.
We hardly knew ye.
This might be the only year. I mean, this could have been a short-lived Jerick McKinnon run. Let's get into the rundown, though.
At least he got paid.
He
did get paid. He got all those monies.
He did get paid. Let's get to the rundown quick, because we're going to get through some of the things that we can dispense quickly. Then we're going to talk a bit about resource allocation, and then we'll talk a little bit about each individual player. So let's first get to the rundown. The 49ers, of course, miss out on Odell Beckham, and the Giants are indeed the new Browns. What I thought the most interesting thing that I read was that the package of picks that they gave the Brown, or that they gave the Giants, right, Peppers and the two picks, are worth about 1.85 wins above replacement. Of course, this is a measurement using EPA to figure out how helpful you are towards winning games over the next 4 years. So 1.85 wins above replacement over the next 4 years. Odell Beckham in 2018 alone worth 1.95 wins above replacement. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. Courtesy of our own Eric Eager, I believe were those WAR numbers, but it's interesting, I think, to look at it, because I think receiver is kind of a weird spot where the guys at the very, very top, right, the guys like Beckham, guys like Hopkins, who have really shown their value in kind of terrible quarterback situations for most of their career, right, and have still been so incredibly valued, because we know, like, to a certain degree, a receiver's worth is heavily tied to his quarterback, right? Like there's only in a lot of cases so much you can do if you have poor quarterback play as a wide receiver. And so the fact that those players, and you know, maybe a couple others here and there, but those two I think stick out in particular of players that have been so valuable with crappy quarterback situations, those are the ones that I think can really have such a major impact for your offense. I think once you fall below kind of that very top end of the spectrum, then you just get this wide, you know, huge group of the next players, where a lot of that then comes down to, well, how do you fit with the other guys, right? What's your offensive scheme? Do you have a guy like Kyle Shanahan who can get players open? And it becomes, I think you can kind of do more with less from that next group. But if you have that kind of top-end guy, I mean, it's incredibly valuable for your offense.
What is Dave Gettleman doing? Because he is single-handedly destroying that franchise.
Oh, it's hilarious. I need it. I need...
You need to not be on the bottom.
Yeah, I need Gettleman right now more than he could ever know.
Oh, did you see the run first offense post about how he's going to trot out a run first offense? I'm
Saquon,
waiting.
Man, he's
going
to have like 700 touches next year or something.
I am waiting for all of that. So next story in the rundown is that we have a long snapper, kind of, sort of, signed Kyle Nelson, long snapper, to a 4-year deal. Only problem is, he's still suspended for the first 6 games of the year because, of course, he was suspended 10 games for using the old performance-enhancing drugs. So the team apparently put an out in his contract that allowed them to basically not execute the contract if they were just happy with the dude that's long snapping now.
That's how you know you're good.
I guess if you're Kyle Nelson, you got to think to yourself, like, long snappers are pretty replaceable. I mean, I'm no kicker, can't get franchised.
Why is this even worth the trouble? It's not worth the trouble talking about.
Just,
it's
just
not
keep
worth
the guy that you have now. It's hilarious.
But, yeah, it's just long snapper, man.
But in better re-sign news, and I put better in air quotes, The 49ers did re-sign Jimmy Ward to a one-year, $5 million prove-it deal. What he's got left to prove, I don't know, but he apparently will ping-pong back to safety, and I think that's the nickname I'm sticking with him, and that's going to be ping-pong, because he's now been nickel, corner, safety, corner, safety, corner safety, kicker holder, hands up, you know, whatever the hell he's going to do. I don't know, man. Like, I don't know why the team, apparently the team loves him. Mayoko said that that the coaches are like, yeah, we love Jimmy Ward. And here you go.
I mean, I guess like is a depth piece, right? It's probably fairly valuable to have a guy like that. You know, if you're going to have, I mean, that's, I think the key part, right? Is I don't know if things break right for Jimmy Ward and he's able to stick at a spot and he plays well, then like, awesome. He probably deserves it after like all the crap that this franchise kind of put him through his first 5 years in the league. But I think it's just kind of, I don't know. I don't know how realistic it is to expect this guy to come in and be a starter if that's actually the plan. I think if you have him as, you know, a backup, you know, having a backup that can play multiple spots like that, you know that you're going to have to deal with injuries at some point in the season, more than likely. Like, sure, yeah, that makes sense. And bringing a guy on like that for a short-term deal is probably pretty smart. But it just, I'm kind of surprised that he wanted to come back, honestly. Like, you think he would have just kind of been like, you know, I want to go to a new team, get a new start, go find a place that's going to let me stay at one position and actually get good at it, maybe.
Yeah, for me, it's one of those things where you know exactly what he is as a player, and you know that at best he is just that. He's a depth player.
Yeah.
So I'm ready to move on, because this is not the one-year prove-it deal that ends up turning out well for you. This is not the Patrick Robinsons of the world where you think to yourself, okay, you come in for 1 year. Oh, hey, you end up being a really, really good corner because, you know, we got a value signing, didn't know what we had. You produced in our system and off you go. He ends up being someone that, like, at best, he's going to be like a middling defensive back. Yeah, and this team is not in need of more middling defensive backs.
Yeah, the high end, like the high end potential of like this move, right, is pretty low, all things considered. It's just like, yeah, like you said, you know kind of what you're getting, and it's very unlikely that you're going to get like a lot of excess value from this deal. Unlike, you know, maybe Jason Verrett, who apparently they're going to visit with, which is maybe if they actually can pull this off and keep him there, maybe my favorite thing that they will have done in free agency so far.
Absolutely. Jason Verrett is someone who is talented. Yes, he's been injured, but this is going to be, if the 49ers sign him, if he clears his physical, one of those value signings that, you know what, at worst, you end up with another injured cornerback that probably didn't produce. But guess what? We've got those in spades. What the hell is different? You just paid one $5 million in Jimmy Ward. Or at best, what's the curve of outcomes in terms of probabilities, right? There's a probability that he could be very, very good, because if he gets back to the form that he had in 2016, then he's probably one of the best corners that's on the team right now in terms of pure talent. Absolutely.
Probably the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of actually putting it together in production, he's someone who's proven that he can perform very, very well in the types of things the 49ers ask their corners to do. And I'm also glad that, height be damned, I'm glad that the team didn't just stay away because, oh, he's smaller, we want our corners to be big and long. It's like, you need dudes who can cover. I don't care if he's 4'11" or 11'4". Can he fucking cover?
They're going to move him to free safety if they sign him, so it'll be fine.
Shut your damn mouth.
Yeah,
shut your mouth.
I think, that's really the thing, right, is when you get kind of to, you know, like the second window free agency signings, really, which is guys that are, you know, you're kind of down to either just lesser players in general that are going to be kind of depth options for you, or guys like Verrett who have something that's kind of been wrong with them and their value's lower. So they're looking for those 1 year deals to kind of go in, rebuild their value, and then go and hit the market again. And that's the option the potential there for just getting so much more value than what that contract's going to be worth, because they're not going to sign him for a lot. I mean, the dude's played in what, like 3 games in the last 3 seasons or something ridiculous like that. He's got like 300 snaps over the last 3 years.
These are the floor models at Best Buy.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with them, but you know what? It's a great deal. It's a great value. And you run a little bit of a risk, but you know what? If it actually pans out, one of two things happens. Either they take a discount because they want to stay with the team that gave him a shot, sure, or they end up leaving for a big dollar contract, and then guess what? You get compensatory picks.
Yeah.
It works out. This is why these signings work out. And instead, the Niners, Maybe they're going to get some management award. Who the hell knows? But Jason Verrett, bright shining star, which is amazing. So, okay, that dispenses with the news. Actually, there's one thing I didn't put on here, and we'll talk about it maybe when we talk about running backs, because I think it's and you know exactly what I'm talking about. But let's get to the 49ers and really the meat of the episode, resource allocation. I've been called all manner of things on Twitter over the last 2 days. I've had to step away from the computer several times. I really should have taken...
Don't engage.
I should have taken a couple days off. I should know better by this point.
You should.
2 days off of work. But I've been not too happy with the 49ers moves as of late. And for me, it's not necessarily about the players that they've signed, although there are some problems with the players that they've signed. To me, it's really about what this tells us about how the team views roster construction, what they prioritize, and how they're trying to rebuild this roster. So what I thought would be great was to look through the lens of what we think is important when building rosters, what we know, what we've learned from other teams, what we know from the amazing analytics that have come out over the last 4 or 5 years about roster construction, and then put the contracts through those various lenses to see how they stack up. So first, let's start with the priors, the things that we believe about roster construction that have borne themselves out over the last few years in the game of football. And the first one is that teams that do well because they prioritize positions of value. And these are also known as positions that have the most impact on winning games. It sounds simple, I know, but it is a fairly radical idea that the NFL kind of intuits in general because they spend a ton of money on quarterbacks, but other positions of value have come up recently over the last few years as really proving their value in the game of football, specifically because they affect the passing game.
Right. The reality is that not all positions are created equal, right? And it has nothing to do with those players. It's not like we hate all running backs and linebackers and don't want them to ever get paid. Like, in fact, like, we're very, I should probably should put this right up front, very pro player. Go get that money.
Go get
like,
the money.
Like, on a very personal level, like, rooting for these players and want to see them get paid and get and screw these teams out of as much money as humanly possible, right?
We just want Dave Gettleman to give the fullbacks all the money.
We just would like the team that we would like to win to not do necessarily all of those things. And so I think, yeah, that's really where you have to start is that not all positions, unfortunately, are created equal. And some of them have a much larger impact on helping you win games. And like you mentioned, it's things that affect the pass games specifically. Everybody knows quarterbacks kind of in its own stratosphere, right? But then after that, you're really getting to, again, coverage players, wide receivers, pass rushers. Like, those positions are the ones that are going to move the needle most when you're looking to be a team that moves from 4 or 5 wins a season to actually becoming a contender, right? It's not the guys that are, it's not your 2-down run stopping defensive linemen. It's not your linebackers. It's not running backs. Like, those guys, even if they come in and do what you expect and do well for what their position asks, they're not going to help you as much as players at other positions will.
And for me, I think while I believe that coverage comes first in the order of importance when you're looking at stopping the pass, I do think that you could make a decent argument that edge is more important than coverage. Those two are related, sure. But the important thing is, I think, to put that in the context of the 49ers specifically. When you're looking at the defense that the 49ers fielded last year, they had league average pressure rate. Right, you had DeForest Buckner, who was very good. You had Cassius Marsh, who was not, but he was still able to get a couple of pressures in there, especially against the Raiders. This was a team that, yes, absolutely needs talent along the edge, but still had league average pressure, and that's good. They've had league average pressure or just about there for the last 2 years, actually. Now, you look at the coverage, and the coverage was by far the worst in the NFL by a wide margin. And if you look at their EPA per play when opposing offenses targeted wide receivers, it was dead last in the NFL. That's courtesy of friend of the pod, George, from PFF. So when opposing offenses passed the ball and they threw the ball to a wide receiver, the 49ers basically said, here you go. We're going to go ahead and this is going to contribute to us giving up lots of points. That's bad. You don't want to give up lots of points. You don't want to lose games. So if you're going to look at your roster and you're going to say, if we're going to overspend, if we're going to say, you know what, we kind of need to overspend in this area, where should it be? It should probably be in the area of coverage.
Yeah, and I think it's very understandable to, I think, still really kind of firmly believe that pass rush comes first, because I think that's kind of the way that it's always been, right? I think this shift is actually something that's really pretty new. If you think about like how offenses worked, you know, kind of even going back decades, really. A lot of it was predicated on kind of downfield passing attacks, right? Like you, a lot of offenses were holding the ball, like taking shots deep. That's why you kind of
Lawrence Taylor, right? Lawrence Taylor and the left tackle and that whole thing. I mean, that's been an axiom in the NFL for years, right? Yeah. Like you have the left tackle who protects the blind side, and you've got, I mean, that was what teams built entire franchises around. You look for the left tackle, you look for the pass rushing guy who only goes up against the left tackle. And that's been a thing that people believed and have known for decades.
Yeah. And so I think you saw obviously you had some teams in there like the 49ers, for instance, and West Coast teams that kind of moved more towards trying to get the ball out a little bit quicker. But largely you saw teams with downfield attacks that held onto the ball a little bit longer. And then you wanted defensively to kind of have that pass rush to go after it. I think when you look at how offenses are structured today, it's so much more about getting the ball out quickly. You know, your average depth of target on throws is down from what it was in previous decades. And so because of that, the pass rush doesn't have the same sort of impact that it used to. And so coverage, there's so many things you can do now to kind of mitigate a really good pass rush. I think you saw that with Kansas City is like a great example last year, right? They had the guy that the 49ers just traded for in D Ford. They had Justin Houston on the other side of him, two of the best, you know, edge rushers in the league last season. And their defense like was basically right there with the 49ers in terms of being the worst in the NFL because they had nobody who could cover on the back end. And if guys are running open and guys are getting open quickly and the quarterback's getting the ball out of his hands, there's nothing the pass rush can do. They can win their rep every single time and still not get home and still not have that same impact. And so the game has really shifted to where you have that coverage that I think really takes priority. You need guys that can cover on the back end and give the pass rush time to get home.
So I think that when overall, right, if the first thing that we're going to operate with in kind of our base of understanding is that you should prioritize positions of value and that those positions of value are valuable because they have the most impact on the passing game. The second thing is going to be that teams want to find market inefficiencies and build their team appropriately. And sometimes these inefficiencies change, but you look at the way teams have constructed their rosters. One of the biggest market inefficiencies is when you have a good QB on a rookie deal. The Rams had that with Jared Goff. You've got even the Seattle Seahawks who had that with Russell Wilson. You're able to stack that team because they have an efficiency in their quarterback deal. Then you look at another way of building that roster, right? Completely different. You have maybe a quarterback you've already paid, the Patriots. They look at mid-level veterans. Instead of trying to project rookies over and over and over again, and especially because you're always winning and you're picking at the bottom of the draft, you think to yourself, okay, where is there an area that I can get some value contractually with player performance that I can't get elsewhere? And so they start staffing their rosters with mid-level veterans. You can glean what these teams are thinking by where they spend their money. That's their biggest action. And they try to find these market inefficiencies and exploit the hell out of them. Trade markets for players. Also similarly, right? The compensatory pick formula, also another inefficiency that people have gained or tried to game in order to get picks. If you can nail one of those and do so effectively, you want to because it gives you a leg up.
Right. You're just trying to create as many opportunities as you can, right? That's what you see good teams doing is they're just giving themselves chances to be right because so much of this is kind of a crapshoot, right? The draft, you know, we've seen study after study show that nobody is better in the long term at kind of beating the draft than any other team, right? You don't draft well, you don't draft poorly, you just kind of draft is how it works for most teams, right? And you hope you luck into some good players, but the teams that do it the best give themselves as many chances as possible, right? And it's kind of the same thing just in general with roster building. You want to give yourself a lot of chances to be right as opposed to kind of having that overconfidence that I'm going to identify. We need this one single player that's going to make the difference for us, and we're going to bank that our evaluation is like 100% correct. And then you kind of give up all your resources to go get those players, and then you're screwed if it doesn't work out, right? You have nothing to fall back on.
Economists Thaler and Massey put together a really good paper that talked about what they call the problem of overconfidence. And this is why oftentimes teams screw up, because they are so confident in their analysis of a player that they end up giving up assets to or giving up resources in order to acquire that player, whether that is trading up in the draft for a quarterback or whether that is overpaying someone in free agency. You are so confident that this is the one guy that other teams then take advantage of you, and you generally don't want to be that team. But the third and final thing is that bad spending decisions don't magically correct themselves. While, yes, the cap is largely an illusion, handing out bad contracts can still impact your ability to put together a winning roster. When you look at the Malcolm Smith deal specifically, yes, he's now restructured it. It's basically a one-year deal. But he's still got 2 years of effectively top-end money for a linebacker that we didn't need to pay if everyone else, if the Niners knew what everyone else knew, which is that he wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Right? And when you look at good teams, they get value from their signings. And this is why rookie deals are so valuable, but this is ultimately why getting production beyond a player's contract is super important. Kevin Clark had a great story on his podcast, on the Ringer podcast, earlier this week, and he was talking to a personnel man in the NFL, and he said that you effectively have the salary cap, and the salary cap is $185, $200 million, whatever the hell it's at, right? It jumps up $10 million a year. But you effectively want to sign players that make it seem like your team is playing at a $250 million cap. And you do that when players outperform the salaries you give them. And so if you give out a bunch of $20, $30, $40 million deals, the likelihood of a player outperforming that, slim to none.
Right. It's just, it's tough when you're paying players what they're worth, right? And it sounds crappy, but that's kind of like from a team perspective and looking at it through that lens, right? You're trying to build the best possible team that you can build within kind of those restrictions. You need to get excess value from players, especially I think when you have your quarterback. I mean, I think you look at Jimmy Garoppolo's contract right now going forward for the rest of it, it's probably the best example that the 49ers have currently of like going to, they're hopefully going to get excess value from that deal, right? He's going to have cap hits that put him, you know, at best in the middle of the pack among quarterback salaries every year. And he's a player that we expect to perform much higher than that. And that is where you really get that value, because then you're getting a player that's giving you more than you're giving him, and you can then devote those resources, that excess that you get, to other players to be able to sign them. And the more often you can do that, the better off you're going to be.
So those are the priors. Those are the things that we think are important when it comes to roster building. These are the things that good teams do, by and large, in order to win in football. So now let's take a look at the contracts and the decisions the team has made over the last couple of days and put them through this lens and figure out whether or not they are good deals. This way you can understand why the hell we've been ranting and raving for the last 2 days. And first, let's get to the first contract that we handed out. We'll call it the Wrath of Quan. I love it. I've got two. The title of the podcast is going to be pretty dope as well. It's going to be probably Quan in a Million.
I mean, the pun game is strong. That's maybe the best part of this signing.
Quan in a Million is up there. Quantified Their Love, I think, was good. But man, the Wrath of Quan. Here we go. So the details. 4-year, $54 million deal, making him the highest paid off-ball linebacker for a few hours, basically until CJ Mosley. Now, and I still think at this point that he is the second or third highest paid off-ball linebacker. He received $27.5 million in injury guarantees, only 14.25 of which is guaranteed at signing. And basically, if he's on the roster April 1st of 2020, his $11.25 million injury guarantee will vest to a full guarantee. So basically, this turns into a deal where they're, much to the 49ers' happiness, there's a couple of ripcords, but if he ends up staying, or if he plays kind of like medium to medium okay, good enough to stay on the team, he ends up making a ton of money.
Right. So I think there's a few things that I think are worth talking about here, right? We know that NFL contracts are stupid and overly complicated and kind of difficult to understand. And so I think there's kind of like three basic ways you end up looking at them, right? There's all the reported value, which is kind of the maximum value, which is stuff that's unlikely to ever actually be realized. You have kind of the bare minimum of that, which is what is the fully guaranteed money, right? What is the money that this team is going to have to pay him no matter what happens? And that's important. It's more important than the face value stuff, but it's still not the full picture, right? And I think the kind of sweet spot is the way to look at it is what is likely to be earned. His first year contract, right? Like all the guaranteed money may be in the first year of the deal. But as we saw with Malcolm Smith, right? It's unlikely that you bring a player in at that value and then only keep him in. He has to be so unbelievably terrible in that 1 year.
And even if he is.
And even if he is, you may not, you've invested enough in him that you want to give him a second chance, right? So technically, like, yes, you can say, oh, they've got an out after they can get out after the first year, they can get out after the second year, right? No money. Well, it's like the team's likely not going to do that, right? They've put this investment in them. He's going to stay there. And so even that second year, you know, may be fully unguaranteed at signing and just kind of made up money that you want to say in the contract. Like, he's almost certainly going to see that money. That is money that's going to be on your cap that season that you cannot spend elsewhere. And I think that's kind of the thing where all the Marathlete stuff, which is great, we've had a lot of fun with it over the years, and he is very good at what he does. And structuring deals in the way that the 49ers do is much better than not structuring them that way, right? Like, having the outs that they build in, you rather have that than not have it. But I think we've gone a little too far in saying that, like, oh, they can get out after this, the first year. They can get out after the second year, right? It's like, why are you signing players that you're so eager to get out of their contracts for, right? You shouldn't be making those decisions to begin with.
And even if you just look at the first 2 years, you're still looking at an average of like $13.5 million over the first 2 years. Yep. Like, his cap number in year one is $11.5 million, and in year two, it's $13.1 million. That still puts him in the upper echelon of off-ball linebackers, which is a position that isn't nearly as impactful as other positions that you had an opportunity to improve at in the free agency period. So let's take a look at the player, because this is also an important part of the evaluation. Where, how good is this actual player? Because if this were Keekly, if this were, you know, Leighton Vander Esch or whatever, you're like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But Kwon is not those things. Kwon Alexander is a fast player, physically gifted, whose best trait is coverage. But even then, his best trait doesn't put him in the upper echelon of coverage defenders when you're looking at linebackers.
It really gets back to that point about trying to get excess value from these deals, right? He's a player that, based on what we've seen and everything that we know about him, which is a good amount at this point, right? This isn't a rookie coming into the league that we're still, you know, very up in the air on. Like, we have a lot of snaps. I think it's like 2,900 snaps of Kwon Alexander playing NFL football. Like, we have a pretty good idea of what this guy is as a player at this stage. And it's unlikely, like, really the best case scenario you're looking at is that he lives up to this deal. And he lives up to this deal at a position that doesn't matter, right? Like, that's not going to move that needle for you. And so I think that's the difficult part. Yeah. So, I mean, looking at his game specifically, I guess if you're going to, you know, look at it from a strength and weakness standpoint, he does have a strength relatively, like, in the better area. Like, it's a better signing, I guess, than going out and getting some, like, run stopping linebacker that's only going to be worthwhile on first down. But it's still, like you said, not there. He's not good enough at coverage to kind of warrant being paid a top tier contract at that position.
Yeah. And so when you look at the percent of the cap over the next 2 years, he's going to basically take up 6.1 and 6.6% of the cap over the next 2 years. That's Telvin Smith type money. And that, I mean, you're talking about some of the best, most athletically gifted linebackers in the NFL. You look at someone else that was also available in this free agency period, and that was someone that we identified, Jordan Hicks. If you're going to take a gamble on someone, take a gamble on someone who is one of the best coverage linebackers when healthy. Because you think to yourself, oh, but Jordan Hicks is injured, right? Like, that's an injury concern. You just signed a guy who tore his ACL in October of last year.
Right.
Clearly, injury is not a concern to you. And you build in some rip cords in the contract in order to you know, kind of figure that stuff out. So I think, you know, okay, so you're going to quibble maybe with the fact that off-ball linebacker is not important. That's still a coverage area. That's still the middle of the field is where good quarterbacks feast. Okay, let's take a look at a metric that helps us measure that. Wins above replacement. That's a really good metric for helping see a player's impact on things that matter. Okay, Kwon Alexander, and this data is thanks to George from PFF, but in 2016, his wins above replacement was 0.27.
A quarter of a win.
A quarter of one whole win. Not great, Bob. But what about 2017? 0.05 wins was his wins above replacement. And 2018, last year, most recent season, before, of course, his ACL injury, zero. He literally did not contribute more than a replacement-level linebacker to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And replacement level is not backup. Replacement level is guy you sign off the street. Replacement level is Elijah Lee.
It's not great. Yeah, I think that, you know, really kind of illustrates you know, we talk a lot about like what's going to move the needle. And this is really kind of what we're referring to, right? The reality is with linebacker, there are very few players who actually move the needle at that position. You're taluking about really like Luke Kuechly, Bobby Wagner, and then maybe depending on the year, you got a couple other guys in that mix that might kind of hit it that year, but they're not consistently there like really those two players have been. So you have a very small number of players who are actually worth market level deals at that position. And it's because once you kind of get below that elite tier, there's just not a lot of difference between those guys, right? So looking at Quan Alexander is like a great example. Like his coverage grades for us like have been decent, right? I think you look at it, what he's done over the last 3 years, it falls right around like the low 70s. The problem is there's like about 50 players that have coverage grades between, say, 65 and 75. There's just a whole swath of players in there.
There's an availability of resources
that give you similar production at that position to what you're likely going to get from Quan Alexander. And the majority of those players aren't costing you a top tier contract. And so that's really what you come back to with this deal, right? It's not that you hate Quan Alexander and he's a completely worthless player. It's just he's not good enough to warrant top-tier money. You could have gone elsewhere, gotten similar production, and saved a ton of money that you could put elsewhere that's more important.
Quite frankly, when I was watching the tape that I did of him over the last couple of days, he's actually kind of a fun player to watch, right? He runs around. He had a couple of really good hits. He is a decent enough zone coverage guy. He is fast as all holy get out. It's fun to watch. Yes, that's great. But the criteria for paying this much money for a linebacker should not be he's fast and he's fun to watch.
I think that's actually like another really good thing to bring up, though, with him. And I think this was something that probably we're going to get into a little bit more once we got into draft talk. But I think it very much applies here in that this is kind of, I think, the biggest difference between more like traditional scouting and kind of what we do at PFF, right? Which is, you can look at Quan Alexander and look at his game and you start focusing in on traits, right? And you see some of these splash plays. And there are some plays that you pull up that are awesome. Like you said, that are really fun to watch, that are great plays that like no one wants to take that away from him. But if you get carried away looking at a handful of games and you see him make a few of these plays and you see the athleticism pop and you think that that makes is like all that it takes to make a great player, like you're missing so much of the picture, right? Looking at three games and seeing some of those plays isn't the same as looking at every single one of his 2,900 snaps over his career and realizing that those plays don't happen all that often. So yes, they're there. But you have to, in order to actually be the difference between players like Quan Alexander and players at the top level of that position are those other guys do it often, right? You see those same sort of plays, but they're doing it so much more frequently. And I think that's something that we really capture with the grades that you don't get in traditional scouting, because you get too caught up in kind of the traits and what can happen. And if he does this, he goes to a good coach that's going to get more out of him. He's going to do it more consistently. And it just doesn't really work that way most of the time.
And then you got a player like Jordan Hicks, who was someone who, especially in coverage, has shown the ability to consistently produce at a high level. And his the percent of cap that he's taking up over the next couple of years is 3.1 and 5%. What could the Niners have done with that extra 2%? Lots of things, like maybe sweeten the pot for Earl Thomas, or they could have done something else. They could have signed Pierre Desir. Right, sure. They could have done lots of things to improve the other areas, because now you're not overspending at positions, but you then can overspend at positions where it matters. So when we get to overspending for positions that matter, let's get to the Ford D Niners. Man,
see what you did there.
Oh yeah, see what I did there? Ford D Niners. This is a good one. I told you, I get one hoppy beer in me and the puns flow.
Puns are going.
That's exactly right. So let's get to the details of the deal. But before we get to the details of D Ford's deal, let's just take a brief moment to hear from our sponsors. All right, so the details on D Ford's deal. The 49ers traded a 2020 second round pick and then additionally paid D Ford 5 years, $87.5 million. That basically averages out to about $17.5 average dollars in millions per year. which we still need some contract details, but I imagine that this deal is going to be structured very similarly to a lot of the other Parag Marate deals, which is that it's going to be a lot of roster bonuses, so he's going to be paid for being active and on the team. So if there's any injury concerns, the guy had a herniated disc not too long ago, so that's a concern. But I imagine there will be lots of those kinds of ripcords in this deal as well. But much like with Quan Alexander, I would imagine that the team is not expecting to see any fewer than 2 years of D Ford on the roster. And so on average, you're looking at about $17, $18 million, which is the going rate for edge rushers nowadays, especially one that produced at the level that D Ford did in 2018.
Right. So I think you start, if you just kind of look at this in more of a vacuum, right? Just I'm only looking at the details of this specific deal and what happened. Really not bad, right? So I think, you know, a second round pick.
D-Ford's good, especially if looking at 2018.
Right. So you're getting a you know, potentially a very, very good edge rusher, a position that you need that is actually valuable that you don't have, you know, players at currently. And really not giving up a whole lot. You know, I think $17.5 million is an average, not terrible. You know, it is still very much a step below, I think, the very best players at that position, right? It's not going to be something that you see guys like Mac or Von Miller or, you know, I think even DeMarcus Lawrence, he's going to get more than that, right? So I think it is below that, which is, again, good to see. I think...
Sorry, I was just looking at Jordan Hicks' first-year cap number, and it's $5.7 million.
Cool.
Jesus.
Moving on. And so, God, that's frustrating. It's wild. God. It's just so frustrating.
Oh, my God. Go ahead.
But, so I think when once you kind of zoom out a little bit, it is where I start to have a little bit more of an issue with this deal, right? Starting point is this is maybe the best offseason that we've seen in a while as far as being able to acquire edge talent without having to give up additional compensation, right? Just looking at the guys on the free agency market, even though, like we talked about before, a lot of the biggest names got tagged and weren't available, there were still a number of players who would be significant upgrades to what the 49ers have that were available in free agency. And then you're coming up on what is, I think, a very, very good draft class for edge rushers, right? So a lot of opportunity to go out and get edge rushers. This isn't like last year where there's just nothing available. You'd like to be able to upgrade, but you just really can't because there's nothing there, right? That was the very opposite end of the spectrum this offseason. Yet, you feel so compelled that you've identified the one player. None of these other players are quite good enough, right? I can't get any extra value from these other players. I found the one player that I need, and so I need to go out in this market that's very advantageous if you need an edge rusher, and I need to give up an extra second round pick to get it. And I think that's the sort of thinking that has become very problematic with this regime right now.
And the thing is that, okay, let's say D Ford, what does he do well? He is a speed rusher. We know this team loves speed, and speed around the edge is the one thing the Niners do not have. What is the other thing that D Ford does well? He likes to line up on the wider side of life, and we know the Niners are going to go to a wide nine and use more wide nine alignments now with Chris Kocurek as a defensive line coach. But he is good at lining up wide and getting around the edge. Okay, he's a scheme fit. That's fantastic. That's great. But is
nah, man, he came from a 3-4. We play a 4-3.
No,
he's only played in a 2-point stance. How is he going to survive in San Francisco? Don't you know we need a Sam? My God, what is happening?
Okay, this whole Sam Leo thing. I will kick you in the dick, David Newman.
Fuck out of here with Sam, you fucking Sam linebacker. Nobody I think gives a shit.
Your tweet was the best, where you could literally alternate a Sam from the crowd every
just
play.
Just pick one. I would like all Sams to come down to the field. Could you please all Sams meet at the logo at midfield, please? One of you lucky motherfuckers are gonna suit up today, and we're gonna give you $75,000. Cool.
But okay, so let's say that he is a scheme fit and he does what you want out of he does well what it is that you want. Okay, cool. Earl Thomas was a scheme fit too, but whatever. Now, if your scheme is so rigid that the only player that will make this scheme pop is the one speed rusher that can sometimes line up in a wide nine, your scheme is terrible. Good coaches will take good pass rushers and utilize them well because they're good at rushing the passer. And so when you think of the available options that are out there and you look at someone like Trey Flowers, who performed very, very well last year and has for a couple of years, and if you're going to, you don't have to give up a draft pick to sign that guy. Okay, cool. He's going to Detroit because he loves the Patriots over there in the Motor City. Great. then you still have Shaq Barrett. You still have other players that are of value that you don't have to give up extra compensation for, because this team is in sore need of players that can perform. And when you're overpaying players like Kwan Alexander, guess what? You probably need to get some production from your rookie class. And that's the last thing you want to do, is start handing out draft picks like they're free, because they're not.
And then, so even if you take all that, right? Okay, fine. Whatever. They made the deal. Hopefully they at least got a guy that's been consistently among the best at his position every year, right? That he's been in the league. Top tier player, no doubt. No, you went and got the one guy that's available that is basically the poster child
in terms
of template for free agents or offseason acquisition that you avoid, which is the one-year wonder pass rusher, right? We've seen it work in both directions, right? We saw DeMarcus Lawrence just last year. He was kind of in a similar boat. Didn't really play well, had a massive season, got tagged, and then he did it again. I'm like, all right, I'm starting to feel a little bit better about giving that guy a long-term deal, right? I think this is where we're at. I mean, again, D Ford has played a lot of snaps in the NFL. This isn't a rookie. He's not even especially young. Dude's going to be 28 this year, which is, you know, fine. Like, it's not like he's old, but he's not like some young dude that's like 24, right? Barely.
If you're worried about paying Justin Houston, who's 30 years old, then what you're saying is you're not worried about paying this guy for just 2 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So Justin Houston, right? 2 years older and yet has had a much longer track record of performance, right? Has done it for many, many years at a very high level. You're going after the one guy that is kind of like had four seasons of really, really iffy play. And you throw out all the excuses you want. The fact is, he was out there for a lot of snaps and wasn't doing a whole lot with them. And then had 1 year where he kind of exploded, and you're really banking on that is the guy that you're getting. And I think in reality,
it's overconfidence again, yeah. Right? It's that I know that what I saw in 2018 with my eyes is going to project into the future. And I know it well enough that I'm going to reward that player with not only a contract, but an extra draft pick, when I could have taken that money and signed Justin Houston, Shaq Barrett, or, you know, anyone not named Ziggy Ansah, basically.
It's just a greater risk, right? It's you're taking what is already, like, there's always risk involved with all these moves, right? Even smart ones, right? Even going after good players at good positions. Like, there's always things. Even Earl Thomas, right? Guy that everybody loves. Everybody wanted Earl Thomas. Everybody thought that he would be a great fit. And, you know, he's not without risk. There's always a little bit of risk involved. But what you're doing is kind of adding unnecessary risk to an already risky process.
And so this is where I think this is a good place to slot in the Earl Thomas discussion. Because for me, this was the deal that kind of put a bow on me thinking this team is just applying their resources in a really inefficient way. Because what is Earl Thomas? He is all pro production at an age that you still have probably a couple of good years left, right? At a position, safety, that you look at safeties that have been able to extend their career for a long time, right? Charles Woodson, Rod Woodson, all of the Woodsons, basically. you know, the safety is not as physically demanding as, say, running back. And so you can prolong your career a little bit there. And Earl Thomas is a player who has consistently played at an all-pro level. He is and has been the best safety in football over the last 3 years. Before he got injured, he was playing at an all-pro level. It wasn't like he was a middling in the middle. Like, no. He was all-pro. He breaks his leg. Okay. If a player is going to get injured and be out for a significant amount of time, a broken bone is kind of what you want it to be.
Really one of the best case scenarios, right?
Yeah, because it's a clean break. You don't have soft tissue damage. There wasn't any nerve damage. You didn't have to put, you know, maybe you put a rod in it or something, but even then, Earl Thomas didn't have to do that. And so bone is going to be a pretty good healing process. There's not it's not like a bone spur into your Achilles heel, which is what Eric Berry has, right? That's a soft tissue issue. Thanks. Yeah, it's not painful. I'm sorry, it's not good. It is painful. But so if you're looking for that type of injury, you're like, okay, this is the kind of risk I'm okay with assuming. Because in the outcome of, like, in the probability matrix, what's the likelihood? There's a likelihood that he gets back to top form. There's a likelihood that he gets back to, like, 80% of form. There's a likelihood that he is complete trash. But the likelihood, based on what we know about Earl Thomas, is that he's going to be very, very good. And you're telling me that you couldn't throw an extra $2 or $3 million per year onto the deal, and that you couldn't guarantee $14 million extra in the first 2 years.
Right. Like, that's one of the, I think, the more concerning things with kind of how things have unfolded this offseason, right? Is, and this may be ventures, I guess, a little bit more into kind of hearsay than I would typically like to go into. But what you keep hearing about some of these moves, right, is you hear things like with Earl Thomas, what kept coming out was they have a price in mind and they're only willing to go up to this price. And you know what? It's probably lower than Earl Thomas's price, right? But we're kind of firm here. This is what we think that he's worth, and this is what we're going to go with. You're willing to do that for an elite player, like a player that is the very best at what he does, that is
tailor-made for your scheme.
Exactly. Perfect scheme fit. And has really shown no signs of slowing down, right? It is, and it's at a position that is important, that adds legitimate value to what you're doing defensively, and is going to be a position that actually moves the needle, right? You're not willing to show some flexibility in what you're willing to pay there, but you are at positions that aren't important, right?
Like
Kyle Juszczyk. So good. It doesn't matter what we got to pay him. We got to get him at no cost. We got to pay four times what any other fucking fullback is making so that we get this one guy at this position that doesn't fucking matter at all. Quan Alexander, this is the guy that we identify. We got to go and get him. We got to pay him more than what the market pay him at a market rate, even though we should have a cost here. Like, these are the positions where you should have a more rigid, like, this is what you're worth. We're not willing to go above this because those positions are so replaceable that you can just go find other guys that give you similar production at the cost that you've placed on them. And so when you're not doing that at positions that don't matter, and you are doing that at positions that do, it's just like a what the fuck are you thinking type of
thing.
It's a weird vortex.
Yeah, it's a weird vortex where, and again, I think it just shows that the prioritization of positions is odd and off for some reason, and I have no idea why. All I know are their actions, and their actions are that they think that a fullback and a weak side linebacker, for some reason, are worth overpaying. You can stretch your dollar to get these specific guys in the building. But Earl Thomas, coverage defender, elite guy, all pro, I don't know, right? Jordan Hicks, great coverage player, I don't know. But then we get into other positions that are not nearly as important in today's NFL, and this gets us to the running back. And so there are two things here that I think are important to call out. One are that the 49ers were apparently very involved in the Le'Veon Bell sweepstakes.
Which is just, come on, man.
Victor Four had a story in The Athletic where he basically said that the Jets, you know, had almost everything on lock, and then the Niners came in with a late push. And the Raiders kind of bowed out early on, and the Niners were the team that kind of, one of the teams that helped kind of mullet, like, muddy things for Le'Veon Bell at the end. The running back position is not a position where you should be spending an outsized amount of your dollars, right? What has CJ Anderson taught us?
This is, and that's the thing that I think is so frustrating, right? Because again, you kind of, you can really understand why people think that running backs are more important than they are. One, they are very fun to watch a lot of times, right? They are players that are incredibly entertaining a lot of times. They get the ball a lot, right? So you're seeing them a lot, and it's and you watch guys like Alvin Kamara and Todd Gurley at times, and all of these players that have been very good. They're exciting. It's fun to watch them. And so you can see that, like, okay, teams are giving them a ball a lot. You know, these are players that are doing fucking badass things. Like, that should be something that's important.
Man,
and
I played running back. That was my thing. That was my jam. I loved it. I loved touching the ball more times than the wide receivers. I loved running, getting hit. That was the fun part. You were an integral part of the offense.
And the thing is that's, I think, so kind of funny with this running backs thing, and it's like, yes, it's, everybody likes to joke running backs don't matter, and it's, I mean, it is kind of funny, at least
it
to
is.
Me. But I think the real reason that the value's not there is that there are so many good ones, right? There are just a million players that are available that are good and that can come in and give you good production at that position. And so,
and not only that, I think the thing that makes them good, or the thing that determines a running back's success more so than the inherent skill within the running back, are things outside of the running back's control.
Oh, 100%.
Like, yeah, the offensive line, which is why C.J. Anderson was able to be very, very good for the Rams. It's not because C.J. Anderson all of a sudden found some magic elixir in Los Angeles and turned into a good running back. It's because that offensive line is great, and the scheme that L.A. runs is awesome. That's why. And yes, you can find running backs that are valuable in the passing game. Todd Gurley, Alvin Kamara, that still has some value. But that skill is findable in players like Duke Johnson.
And this was, you know, I think the season, right? So it's, again, you can kind of understand it. And there's also the fact that it's just like, that's been so ingrained in football just for fucking ever. And you see every one of these like former players talking about the run game. And it's just like, it's so hard to get away from. But this was the year, if you were paying attention, that was the single best year to illustrate like how replaceable some of these guys are, right? Because you saw so many marquee players get replaced and their teams just kept moving along, right? Le'Veon Bell sat out the entire season. James Conner came in, was probably better than what Le'Veon Bell was.
And Le'Veon Bell should have set the market for running backs. If NFL teams by and large, not named the New York Jets, thought that he was so important, they would have paid him at $17, $18 million a year, which is what he wanted, and they didn't. They paid him at a much more reasonable salary for, well, not a running back, but lower than what he got from the Steelers, which wasn't the kind of backbreaking deal that he wanted to get.
Yeah, and so you had that example. You had Todd Gurley, right? Everybody saw C.J. Anderson late in the season and throughout the playoffs come in there and be able to, and see that offense do just as good as they did with Todd Gurley in there. You had Kareem Hunt going and kicking a woman, getting kicked off of the fucking team, and then you have Damian Williams stepping right in into the Chiefs miss a beat. Absolutely not.
Like Cleveland Browns, 2019.
Yeah.
Kick field goal nets, not women.
That's the one thing that you kind of puts right. Throws some cold water on that whole situation.
And even the 49ers, right? The 49ers lost Jerick McKinnon. Matt Breida comes in. He performs well. And then he gets injured. You have Raheem Mostert. He comes in. He plays well. And then he breaks his arm. Jeff Wilson comes in and he plays well. This is not unique to the 49ers, although the 49ers probably have a leg up in terms of the scheme and Bobby Turner.
Sure.
But they're able to find players that can produce and produce well at the position. So why then would you entertain the thought of paying someone like Le'Veon Bell a whole bunch of money? And then you do something else, and you sign Tevin Coleman. You sign Tevin Coleman to a two-year deal, $10 million max value. We haven't seen the details. I haven't been on Twitter, so I don't know what the hell the details are, right? But I would imagine that there's some incentives in there, and off you go. But the Niners are already invested in the running back position at a pretty high degree for our tastes.
So high.
You've got Jerick McKinnon and Kyle Juszczyk, who are two of the highest paid running backs, full stop, not highest paid fullback and highest paid running back. Two of the highest paid running backs in all of the NFL, right? Which, okay, you can justify lots of things, and especially if you fill out the bottom of that position group with undrafted free agents and rookies, maybe it sometimes evens out, and okay, whatever. Shanahan is on offense. He knows what the hell he's doing. He's figured it out. But then you've got this player now that you then give even more money to, and you tie up more of your cap at a position where you have already proven that you can find the skill at that position in other players, and it just seems like a bit of a head-scratching move.
It's so hard to try and understand why they would want to do this, right? I think, one, if you look at so if they keep everyone, right? So if they bring in Coleman and they aren't giving up, because I think that's kind of the first thing that where my mind went to, at least, is if they're bringing on Coleman, like, are they about to bail on McKinnon without even actually having him see the field, right? Are they going to cut that? Because this is, again, what the contract allows you to do.
What I've seen is that this is insurance in case McKinnon's knee isn't back as early as you would want it to. Because McKinnon was, of course, signed due to his performance in the passing game. And that's good. That's how you want a running back to perform. This is why Alvin Kamara is great. And this is what Tevin Coleman did very, very well in Atlanta. One of my favorite Shanahan plays is the sail concept in the end zone or in the red zone when the running back is running the corner route. It throws defenses for loops. It's wonderful. Tevin Coleman runs it very, very well. So I'm sure will Jerick McKinnon. So will lots of other fast running backs. but I think it's a bit of insurance, right? If I'm saying, okay, this makes sense, that's probably why.
Right. So, I mean, that's not why it makes sense. But it's still like... So I think on one hand, right, there's kind of two directions that you can end up going with this. You are either going to keep everyone. You're going to keep McKinnon around. You're adding Coleman to the mix. Obviously, you're committed to Juszczyk at this point. You picked up his option for this year. Then you're stuck with, you know, if we kind of just assume for now that Coleman's contract is roughly evenly split over the 2 years, you're looking at three running backs with cap hits in 2019 of over $5 million, Juszczyk being the highest one of them, which is just fucking mind-boggling. But three. So you're looking at, like, I think it's probably a little over $16 million of your cap space going to running backs. And it's just like that money would be so much better used going to other positions, right? If you're going to, and that's the thing I think that where we come back to with risk and free agency, right, is there's always going to be some risk. And if you're going to make riskier moves than is probably necessary to make, than like you would normally advise in most situations, at least make it be in an area where there's actually a really high reward that could potentially go out there, right? A guy like Jason Verrett, a lot of risk, but he's at a position that matters, and the high-end possibility of what could happen there is a game-changing thing for your defense. And so would you rather spend $16 million on a position where you know you can get production for significantly? You could probably get the same production for guys that are making $3, $4 million in total. And so would you rather use that extra $12 million and go, let's go sign a couple cornerbacks, right? We talked about this cornerback class, not great. But if I'm going to take some shots and I'm just going to kind of throw stuff against the wall and see if it sticks, I'm going to go to a position where there's an upside, where there's a chance that it actually makes a difference. Go sign a couple of these crappy cornerbacks. Maybe you get lucky, right? And that's where I think just kind of where they're deciding that they need to devote resources. Because even though they have all this cap space, you know, one thing we haven't really talked about, and I don't know how much it's worth getting into, is like there's also like the cash flow element to that, right? Which is like, how much are they have all this cap space, are they actually going to be willing to spend all that cap space? Like, probably not.
I don't know. Aren't. I think that I want to get to that question, but there's one other thing I want to mention in the context of running backs and who, not just the cap hits, but if you do keep all of them, then who the hell plays? Because you've got Matt Breida, who, again, this Matt Breida is the textbook example of the player you want on your team. He has outsized production for his contract. He is dirt cheap.
Undrafted.
And he is phenomenal in terms of production for the amount he's getting paid. That's the guy you want to keep because it allows you to go spend money on Jimmy Garoppolo or on D Ford or on whomever it is that you want to spend it on. Hopefully they are at valuable positions. But then instead of capitalizing on that, you go and you sign McKinnon, you have Juice. You're not going to carry that many running backs on game day. Yeah. So if you've got one fullback and you've got Jerick McKinnon and basically, and let's say that you have Raheem Mostert because he's your special teams ace, now you've got one position on the roster that's either picked up by Tevin Coleman or Matt Breida, and you're sitting one or the other, right? Yeah. Think about what that means in terms of roster construction. Why not just not have Tevin Coleman at all and just go with Matt Breida? The only thing I can think of is that it's insurance and maybe he gets cut before the season starts. But if they end up cutting someone like Matt Breida, then what they're doing is they're saying, I would rather pay more for similar production.
Yeah.
And that makes no sense to me.
Breida, like, again, may not be the best from a talent standpoint of those three, but he is the most valuable. You are getting roughly similar production from him at just a fraction of the cost, right? Yeah. So you're stuck either getting rid of him or keeping him inactive on game day. If you happen to keep them all on the 53, right, you're likely going to keep him or one of these guys inactive on game day, or you're cutting ties, or you've basically decided that we want Tevin Coleman and we're giving up on Jerick McKinnon after 1 year in which he didn't play, right? And so again, it just goes, it's just,
but now let's get to the actual cap implications, right? So the other thing that we hear often is, oh, we've got plenty of cap space. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't matter because, you know, you've got $60 million in cap space. You can pay Juice $12 million. You can pay every running back on the roster an extra $5 million, and you still have $40 million in cap space. So it doesn't matter. Why are we complaining about it?
It's because you're not going to spend all that money, one. And two, like, if you are going to spend all that money, that's money you could spend elsewhere. Again, you say it over and over again, but like, there's really not a better way to put it. It's just like, that is money. I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't take into account seriously enough when evaluating offseason deals is opportunity cost. Every move that you make and everything that you do in the offseason prevents you from doing other things. You're choosing among all of the possibilities of things out there. And we're not saying that they have realistically a chance to sign every single player or trade for every single player that's available, right? Like maybe Odell Beckham just didn't want to go there. And it sounds like maybe that's the case, right? He wanted to go to a couple places. The 49ers weren't on that list. Cool. That's not really what this is about. It's not specific cases. It is of all of the options that you do have available, you are choosing to devote resources to things that matter less than others, right? It's just a matter. You want to, again, put your resources in positions that actually make a difference in your win-loss record that's going to help you become a team that goes from, if we get a full season out of Jimmy Garoppolo right now, like maybe we're a fringe 500, you know, maybe we're getting to a playoff spot or contending for that, to a team that actually can contend and like compete for a championship, right? It's those differences, because some of these positions you do have to just kind of throw a lot of players at, right? I think coverage is one of those. Coverage is...
The Eagles did that their Super Bowl year, right?
It's more volatile, right? So it's that's you know, another part of like the pass rush coverage thing is that coverage is a little bit more volatile from year to year. It's you have less chances to really evaluate players in coverage than you do players in pass rush. So we know a little bit less about those guys, which ups the risk just a little bit. But in that case, you want to devote more resources there, right? You need to get more guys in the building, let them compete. And then the chances are you're going to hit on some of them, right? Bring in a bunch of them. They're not all going to work out, but hopefully you get enough of them that work out that you're fine. And those are the type of moves that you want to see teams make, right? I think that's what we're seeing smart teams make. The Chiefs, they have obviously everything in place that they want offensively. They had these pass rush. They had the pass rush, and they decided, no, we want to get rid of these guys, reshuffle things. We're going to bring in coverage. What do? They signed Tyrann Mathieu. They're bringing in who's the corner from Philadelphia that I've already forgot his name that's decent. Not Roby, but...
Yeah, I was like, Bradley Roby?
No, yeah. Ronald Darby.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So they're swapping out, you know, pass rush for coverage. Saw the Patriots do that, right?
Well, and the Patriots also did something smart in terms of pass rush, and they let Trey Flowers walk, and they're like, okay, cool. But what did they do? They paid for Stephon Gilmore, and they said, I'm going to replace Trey Flowers with someone like Michael Bennett, who, yes, is a little bit worse. He may be even a lot worse as a pass rusher, but the value that I'm getting because of the contract right. that I'm able to actually have him at, he's outperforming the amount of dollars I'm getting him. And that means I can go spend money on other things. And that is the kind of roster building model that is fantastic and works, because there you can throw it a buttload of resources when you have a rookie quarterback on a rookie deal. The Niners don't have that. They skipped that part of roster development. When they went to Jimmy Garoppolo and they paid him this much money, they needed to change into something a little different. And I don't know that they've realized that. Instead, they've turned into this, I think the middle of the field matters, and linebackers and running backs, I'm going to throw a lot of money at, but coverage defenders, Jimmy Ward, okay. Let me go ahead and pass on Earl Thomas.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think you get a lot of comments when you bring stuff like this up on Twitter that's funny, because they're like, oh, of course, like, you know more than John Lynch and Adam Peters and blah, blah. And it's like, I think really it's, this stuff isn't that hard, looking at it from a big picture perspective, right? I think it's if you actually just kind of sit back and look at things and study like what other teams are doing, good teams do pretty much the same type of things, right? They make the same type of moves. They view things in a similar way. And so you just sit back and say like, okay, let's do those type of things, right? And right now what we're seeing the 49ers do is go very much against the grain with where the league is kind of trending and where you see smart teams devoting resources. They're kind of going in the complete opposite direction right now.
So I think final thoughts overall so far in the first couple days of free agency, which supposedly it starts tomorrow or whatever, but
it started today.
Yeah, it's today. Already, yeah,
air
right.
quotes.
It's over
today.
It started at the combine. But I think final thoughts for me overall on the players is, as a 49ers fan, I want every one of these players to be out of the park home runs,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
I want Kwon Alexander to be the second coming of KJ Wright at his prime. I want him to be just a blend of
Bobby Wagner.
A combination of Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, because Bobby Wagner didn't play well. I'm trying to get the position and the
Wagner's
play and
the good one, not right. Fuck
Wright. That's motto for life. Fuck Wright. So the other thing I think is that, and I want D Ford to be amazing. I want all these players to be phenomenal, but that still doesn't take away from the fact that the way the Niners are applying resources and managing their resources is a bit head scratchy. And for me, it just shows a divide between the coaching of the team from the product on the field and their prowess as personnel evaluators. Because if you boil down the personnel part of the job into two things, it is the ability to evaluate talent and put a value on that talent. They, you know, you can quibble about whether they have issues with evaluating talent. I think there's enough data points that maybe they do have issues with that. But even if you just put that aside, there was one thing that Trent Baalke did well, and that was the valuation of talent. Right? He obviously was awful at evaluating talent, but he had a pretty good handle on the valuation of talent, unless you're talking about Vance McDonald. and so I think that that's the one area that I would love to see John Lynch like turn a new leaf at. And I don't know if that's going to happen because we know that someone's style is generally pretty sticky. Like the way that someone is, their base behaviors usually doesn't change or shift in a dramatic way from one year over to the next. The Riverboat Rons of the world, I think, are rare. And so if I think we have enough data points in the valuation of both positions that matter in the NFL and how much you pay positions that don't, that really concerned me when it comes to the front office.
Right. It's I think the reason that we get, I think, a little bit more upset with some of this stuff than a lot of fans do is it's really, are you looking at it from a process perspective or an outcome perspective, right? The sad thing is, like, I think this team, if you go out there with Jimmy Garoppolo healthy for 16 games, the fact that you just have him and Kyle Shanahan as your guy that is designing and calling offense on your team, that is enough that you're going to almost certainly have a 500 record or better. You're going to get to that like 8, 9, 10 win range just on those two alone, because those are so, so important, right? Having the quarterback place is just so much more important than everything else that we've talked about.
And I think from the kind of one level up from team building, the hiring an offensive-minded head coach that has right. an innovative system that is on the cutting edge of what the NFL offenses are kind of doing right now is also incredibly valuable. And that's something that Jed York lucked into, because that is also incredibly valuable.
So that's, yeah, I mean, really you've hit kind of the two most important things. I think if you're kind of like building out a little outline here for team building, like these are the things that are at the top of your list, right? Is hiring the right coach that's offensive minded, that's going to be willing to, kind of adapt and implement new things and adjust to the players that they have and all that stuff. And then of course the quarterback, right? You've hit on those two things, but right now you're doing everything else poorly. Everything else around that to maximize those two home runs that you've potentially hit there in your coach and quarterback, you are not doing everything that you can to get the most out of them, to give them the best chance to lead you to playoff wins and Super Bowl wins and all that stuff, right? You're making it incredibly difficult because you're valuing right now the wrong things.
Yeah, and I think overall that's why I think the free agency thing has been so frustrating for me. And I mean, I do look forward to having these players succeed, because at the end of the day, I'm still a fan of the team and I want them to succeed. But I remember when we signed Juszczyk, or when the Niners signed Juszczyk, and I remember when they signed Malcolm Smith. I remember us specifically saying on the podcast, I don't know that this is going to be a problem, but put this in a bin of things that we might return to when we're looking at evaluating their decision-making ability. And like, that's exactly what it was. Back then it was just like, I'm going to go ahead and flag this because we don't know enough about John Lynch at this point. He was a broadcast guy that came in. We didn't know if he was going to be Matt Millen, or we didn't know if he was going to be something else. Right. And now I think after three off seasons, we have enough data points, at least I do, to be a little concerned. And I don't think that Shanahan's blameless in all this, because he still has the kind of head honcho decision making. But it's concerning.
It is. I think, and that's really the thing that's tough, is because it's like they're gonna make all these decisions, right, that I think you can see issues with. And I think that's why it's important. Like, the wait and see people drive me insane, because like there's no value in trying to, like, the whole thing that teams are trying to do. And if you're a fan that like cares about trying to understand this stuff and trying to like see, like, is this going to help my team win, right? Which I think if you're probably still listening to this podcast, you're one of those people that wants to know more why, right? Why things are happening and try to understand that. Like, it's just, it's tough to wrap your mind around the decisions that they're making. And it's just, again, it's more than a 1 year thing at this point, right? It's beyond just kind of flagging this for concern. We've moved on. We're in year three of this now, and we're still making the same sort of decisions. And it's tough because they may just, again, they may still be good. They may still be good and like mediocre good enough, right? Yeah. To where you look back and people are going to say, oh, look, none of these decisions matter. They won 9 games. They improved to 9 games. You know, that's they were competing in the last couple of weeks for a playoff spot. Maybe they got it. Maybe they didn't. Whatever. But things worked, right? And maybe Quan Alexander has an okay season. D Ford has a pretty good season. And like none of these guys are especially bad. But that margin is the difference, right? That's the difference between being a good enough team and a team that actually can realistically compete for championships.
All right, so that about does it this week on this free agency podcast. Man, I think overall there's still the draft to add more talent, cheap talent, talent that can overperform. And, you know, there's still the 4 podcasts we have planned on whether or not Houston plays Sam or Leo and where you put Joey Bosa. Because David, shout out to David C. From Twitter, who's going through his own mess in his own country right now. So thanks for that question, yeah. Buddy. Good luck in Canada. But that about does it. You can always follow me on Twitter if you haven't already listened to my bullshit there. It's at Better Rivals. David, where can they follow you?
It's going to be at PFF David. I pretty much just make jokes anymore. I don't want to argue with people.
Tune in next week because next week we will start our draft breakdowns. And I think we may start with Edge, I think is what we decided. But
yeah, so we'll see. We'll probably wrap up. I mean, I'm sure there'll be
some more free agency stuff.
Some more free agency news. We'll kind of wrap up, touch on some of the players there, I'm sure. But yeah, really start getting into this draft class, which should be a little bit more fun, I think, at least when you're in the preview mode. It's fun to get excited about some of these players and see kind of what this class has to offer. So yeah, we'll be on it.
Absolutely. So tune in next week. And as always, go Niners.